Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Marcus Collins of the Texas Tenors. Their newest PBS special, Rise, has air dates on KVCR-TV quite soon. More on that later in the program. Tonight we also have Ben Perper in conversation with comedian John Pate about his debut novel, Tears of Guduoff, drawing some interesting comparisons to today. We're going to start with another book and a look at spending time under the stars with Manuel Rogers in conversation with Dan White.
Joining us now is Dan White, author of Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. Thank you for joining us today, Dan.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. How did your love of camping start and when?
My love of camping started in an unlikely way. You know, with my kid, I've got a daughter, and I started off with baby steps, car camping, you know, get out there. I even bought a little futon mattress, baby steps, so she didn't get too freaked out by this experience. And, you know, I didn't want her to become a reactionary and anti-wilderness or anything like that. I wanted to gradually introduce it, but my dad was having none of that. He was a true wilderness romantic, and when he took us camping, even as a little kid, he'd haul us out into the raw wilderness with a full-on exterior frame packs and dehydrated food and, you know, sucrose tablets and wow, dehydrated meatballs, and we'd go all the way out to some buggy meadows way off the beaten track, just far away from anybody, and have a really raw, rugged wilderness experience with bears running around. And it was crazy. But for me, it was this pretty wild indoctrination. I learned to love that pretty quickly. It's such a sense of adventure out there. It's a whole different world. And that just stuck with me. And as the years went by, I just really wanted to explain how recreational, as opposed to, you know, necessary or survival camping, took hold in this country, why so many people do this, how these different camping traditions got started from survival camping to why people make s'mores. I really wanted to look behind all these things that I took for granted and kind of tell the hidden stories of all these things.
Okay. We'll get back to that s'mores one later, I hope.
Quite a story for that one, by the way.
Then I'm definitely interested. But before we get there, I understand that there are two men that have something really in common here, John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt, in relation to the national parks. Will you tell us what that is, and also, when did camping begin in this country?
Well, really quickly, with the camping, was initially all there ever was in this country. The first real campsite in this country was discovered. It's 15,000 years old in the Texas Hill Country, not far from where is now Austin, Texas. And obviously not recreational camping, but, you know, amazingly enough, it had a lot of things in common with the kind of place we would want. It had water, ready, available food source. It was nice and shady, and people went out of their way to go to that campsite. You know, and really, as far as recreational as opposed to survival camping is concerned, you had people messing around with it a little bit as far back as colonial days, but people kind of tended to think they were a little bit kooky. You know, you had people experimenting with pleasure camping even in the 1720s. In 1818, there was a lawyer who just got bored. His name was Estwick Evans, and he decided to do a long-distance hike just for the heck of it, starting in New Hampshire and going into the Western Territories while he was wearing sandals and a buffalo robe. Now, he didn't do that for survival. He did it for a soul-building recreational experience, and people thought he was nuts.
Right.
They thought he was crazy. But camping didn't really start becoming standardized and a thing until really the middle of the 19th century, and then continuing onward to the dawn of the 20th century. That's when it really started to become more of an American tradition, started to become more accepted. And then as the 20th century rolled on, it initially was really a pastime kind of for snobs. It used to be very elitist, used to be overwhelmingly male.
Mm-hmm.
And as the years went by, it began to spread out to different socioeconomic levels.
So actually, at that point, you had to have somebody you were bringing along to carry things and who could actually cook and do things.
That's a great observation, because that's the thing that is so weird. So when I'm talking about things that we take for granted, see, doesn't it seem only natural that we would go out there on our own or with our families and haul out a tent and just go for it and do these things and chop the firewood and cook the dinner? In the old days, in the 19th century, or for a big part of it, the big tradition was to hire an extremely skilled wilderness guide who not only cooked the food for you, but he had a guide boat. In the Adirondacks, they have these rivers and lakes, and you could have a guide boat where they carry your wine and your fine foods, and he would just micromanage the whole camping experience for you. And what blows my mind is in some of those Adirondack trips in the 19th century, you didn't even need to take a tent, because a skilled guide could clear-cut a part of the forest. You say, yeah, I'd like to camp right here. He would clear-cut that part of the forest and take the bark off the trees and build you a one-use shanty. Like for one night, you sleep there, it keeps the rain off you, and then he would just leave the thing to rot. Because wilderness was considered this inexhaustible resource. And the camping guide was also considered kind of a bodyguard because people in those days were still shaking loose from this traditional terror of the woods. So they felt like a camping guide could protect them from the ravenous beasts of the woods and so forth.
Such as other people.
Oh, other people too. See, that's the thing, is that the encounters with savage beasts in the Adirondacks were quite rare, but sometimes the camping guides and their clients would mistake each other for bear or deer, and they would inadvertently shoot one another, unfortunately. That was a common cause of death, was getting shot by your guide, or maybe you shoot the guide by accident because you think they're a deer.
Oh, wow. I'm glad we have those orange vests now.
Exactly. In fact, that would be an interesting thing to investigate, is the origins of those glowing orange vests, which I once backpacked with those in Northern California during a deer hunting season when I was backpacking there. I remember wearing this big orange vest on top of the pack so people wouldn't mistake me for a buck and try to make me into a trophy.
This is not included in the book Under the Stars. How do I mistake a person for a deer? What is going on?
I was thinking, because I've never, ever gone hunting in my life, but my feeling is when you're wanting something to be something, you can kind of transpose. I remember one time going to the Pinnacles National Monument out here in California. They have some condors there. They're a magnificent bird. And if you're looking for a condor, it's easy to look at a vulture and mistake that for a condor just because you're willing it to be something it isn't. So perhaps that's what's going on in that quick one-second decision. You're thinking it's a deer. You want to bag yourself a deer, and maybe your mind's just playing tricks on you. I have no idea. And maybe it's just the fog of just being out there and being confused in a confusing forest. It's another possibility.
I'm Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Dan White, author of Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. We were talking a little bit about John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt in relation to the national parks. Tell us what they have in common.
Oh, of course. John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt, in very different ways, were preservationists. Roosevelt was more practical, more utilitarian than John Muir. And of course, Teddy Roosevelt absolutely loved to go hunting and shoot stuff, and John Muir was very much against that. But these two very powerful, very influential men, what they had in common was a few nights in 1903 when they camped out together, amazingly enough, in Yosemite National Park. And they had a common cause in wanting to protect the national park. At that time, incredibly, Yosemite's Valley was not part of the main national park, and neither was the Mariposa Grove. And John Muir was able to convince Roosevelt to preserve these things and to expand the national park. And so they really came together and had common cause, at least on that one particular issue, and they were pretty good friends.
Now, that is great, because they did a lot to help preserve the national parks for us. So that is a great thing that they got together.
And now, the other amazing thing is, if you think of the level of security that would happen now if you had someone who was the president of the United States and this famous preservationist going out and camping in the woods together, I even wonder if that would ever happen. Just the amount of planning you need to do. This was basically the president, John Muir, a couple helpers, and there were some other people standing by, but it was a pretty simple occasion. It was pretty elemental. And they just had a basic camping experience. They had a chance to catch up and to talk, and it really created a bond between them. It lasted at least a little while. It fell apart in time, but for a while it created a real understanding between the two men.
You know, as you bring that up, if we had it today, I'd be wondering more, what kind of medications are being prescribed for these guys to think that they can just go out and camp two or three guys with the president?
Aren't you visualizing like snipers set up like a perimeter and then like helicopters kind of circling around and around in this whole army of people that would be stationed out there for security? It's one of those things that just shows you how much the times have changed, unfortunately. Because people were coming up to them. When they were camping at this meadow, there about 1,000 people were running after Muir and Roosevelt, and Roosevelt had to say to one of his helpers, get rid of these people. Now, can you imagine these days the president of the U.S. with well-wishers just walking right over to him with no one to protect him? Just, hey, how are you doing? Have a good camp out. So it's just simpler times, I suppose.
Yeah, it'd be great to walk up to the president's campsite and have them say, hey, there's the coffee over there, here's some beans. Sit down and join, you know?
That would be really a nice thing.
It really would. Now, I don't want to get stuck here too long, but there's something I have to ask you, Dan, and that is about what happened to you while you were camping in the nude and you had some uninvited guests.
Oh, I sure did. The whole point of the book is to guide people through history, to make it a lived experience so people really feel like they're there. You know what I mean? So
right.
I'm not only showing you the history of camping, but having these on-the-ground experiences. And so I was trying to pay tribute to this fellow named Joseph Knowles, who was a survivalist in the early 1900s who went out to camp totally naked for 2 months in Maine. He said, I'm just going to go out there with my bare hands and just live off the fat of the land.
Okay.
So I decided to pay tribute to Joseph Knowles by camping naked, not for 2 months. I figured easily enough, I'll just go out there. It'll only be 24 hours. What's the worst that can happen? So what happens the second I show up naked to the camping area off the beaten path, far away from anybody? The first thing that happens is I get attacked by a whole bunch of really angry and highly territorial and aggressive yellow jackets. It's not a good thing in the best of circumstances to be attacked by yellow jackets, but when you've got no clothes and you cannot retreat to your tent and you've got no spray or anything, I felt quite helpless, to be honest. So that was not one of my highlights, for sure.
Wow. I mean, and without food or water, this wasn't glamping.
Yes, what I tried to do, I had this terrific wilderness guide who was my kind of wilderness guru who helped me do this. His name is Robin Bliss Wagner. And what he did was looked at a topo map, and he found a place where there'd be fresh running water coming right up from the ground in a spring, you know, as clean as you can get. I didn't want runoff from creatures and such.
Right.
So we had to bushwhack to get to it, and I ended up camping myself next to the spring. But the scary thing about a riparian corridor is that's where the mountain lions hang out. I didn't see one, but all night long when I had no flashlight and was sleeping on the forest floor, I kept imagining they were seeing me and sniffing me. So that was pretty unnerving. I think I slept for about a minute that night.
I really don't know what to say. It's like the yellow jackets pretty much stole the story there.
I think they stole the story because I think I just wasn't expecting things to go south so quickly.
Right.
I think that when you're camping naked with nothing in cougar territory, you have reason to be kind of vigilant, right, and look around in case that's your surroundings. But I think I just wasn't expecting the yellow jackets. It just was so sudden. They just came after me so quickly. And then after I got stung, I mean, yeah, that just really influenced the course of the camp out, and that was that. So,
wow.
Not something I would really wholeheartedly recommend to people.
No.
Sure.
With that kind of fun going on, you also say in your book that there are two kinds of fun in camping. What are they?
I was in the Adirondacks and someone told me this. They're the two funs, right?
Okay.
The fun you're having at the time of the camp out and the fun that you have through the act of retrospection. The two funs. Now, the ideal situation is you've got these twining funs where you have a good time, you know, while you're camping, and you've got a good time in retrospection. But I'm not sure if you found this for yourself, but I find that a lot of times you'll have a camping tale, even the thing with the yellow jackets and camping naked, where you relive it through the retelling and it kind of becomes enjoyable in retrospect.
Yes.
Because unless something really horrible, wretched happens to you, then usually you can reclaim the enjoyment of the camp out, either through the act of retrospection or through the act of storytelling. There's some intrinsic value even to the camp outs that are kind of nightmarish. I think that one reason people are so attracted to camping is because they're bored and stressed out by routine. And with camping, there's a bit of kind of engineered chaos.
Yes.
You can't always predict what the outcome is going to be.
Wow. Dan, where can our listeners find more information about your book, Under the Stars, and other works that you've done?
They can find out all about me and my other work at danwhitebooks.com.
All right. Now, Dan, what are the most popular places for campers to visit in the U.S. and why?
Yosemite Valley is always just inundated. The Grand Canyon is just absolutely inundated. And I think that managing the popularity of places is something we all need to think about, because I think we all need to be aware of loving national parks, loving these beautiful places, but not loving them to death. There's a chapter that I have called The Immaculator about my trip on Mount Whitney, in which I talk about the way that we can kind of trash certain landscapes without trying to do
right.
that. So I hope to draw attention to things like Leave No Trace and Minimal Impact and things like that, too.
Well, Dan, Under the Stars is really, it's a fun book, and it's also very interesting and has some great historical facts. Thank you for joining us today.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Dan White. Again, more on Dan and his books at danwhitebooks.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, Lillian Vasquez speaks with Marcus Collins of the Texas Tenors on KVCR-TV in the very near future. First, though, Ben Perper speaks with John Pate about his debut novel, Tears of Guduhov, with some interesting parallels to today.
Tears of Guduhav is your first full-length novel. Was writing fiction something you've wanted to do for a long time or a relatively recent development?
Well, I think that probably one book is about all I have in my system. This particular book, it came from a story that I heard when I was a kid and had heard the legends and everything about probably 50 different legends about the same story. But the one that I wanted to follow was the one that was personal. So I decided, well, I'm going to kind of amalgamate them all together, all the different versions of the story together, and put it into one novel. And this is what turned out.
Do you know if there's any historical basis? I know you did a lot of research for the novel. Do you know if there was any historical precedent for the legend that happened in this particular book?
Yes. Well, the historical basis of the actual legend of the Confederate gold, that's widely known. In fact, if you do a Google search on the legacy or the legend of the Confederate gold, you'll find that that was one of the big plans during the Civil War of how the South was going to revitalize or regenerate its growth from this gold and silver shipment that was supposed to be sent from Richmond but was lost and never found. And especially in the Deep South, if you went to 20 different communities, you would get 20 different versions of, it's around here somewhere. But nobody ever knows because it vanished into thin air. So this particular story, it centers around the Confederate gold but is more involved with the people around the Confederate gold, not just the idea of finding the treasure. But what happened to the people involved, I thought that was what made the remarkable story, so I decided to focus on them. And those were the people that lived in this village of Guduhav.
Mm-hmm. One of the people you dedicate your book to is Red Skelton, and you say he introduced you and mentored you in creative writing as well as comedy. How did your relationship move from comedy to fiction?
In regards to what he gave me, he gave me one great tip, especially in terms of writing and creating. He would say, picture yourself in the audience, visualizing what you want the audience to see. Now, if you can do that and you're entertained, then you're probably doing a good job. So I decided to do that. I decided if I were going to read this novel, what was it that would be the most compelling things that would interest and entertain me? And this is what came out.
Before you entered into creative writing, you had several writing credits on TV shows. What was the transition from television to fiction like?
Well, most of that was comedy writing. I wrote for Florence Henderson's show for quite some time on the Nashville Network, the TNN Network. I did that for several years. And then I did some specific writing for everybody. I wrote jokes for Jay Leno on The Tonight Show, and occasionally he would use those. And I wrote a production show for Disney Corporation for their Tokyo Disneyland, and then I also had a chance to write for Barbara Mandrell's show when she was performing in Branson, and also for her sister's show, Louise Mandrell, when she was performing in Pigeon Forge. So I would get little sporadic jobs like that, just simply writing comedy and sketches and things along those lines. But this is the first serious novel I ever had. I even wrote a children's book. I have a children's book entitled Harville Goes to the Farm, and it's about a little moose that visits his uncle and aunt on the farm, and that was out for a while and did fairly well. But as far as serious writing, this kind of lent itself toward the storytelling angle, and I really wanted to tell the story. I think that one of the things that is especially lost for this generation is the fact that we do have the internet, and it's at our fingertips, and people feel like, well, I don't need to know it because I know where I can find it. And as a result, we've lost the art of storytelling, and before it was lost on an entire generation of being able to share this story, I wanted to get it out there.
Yeah, definitely. We're here with John Pate, comedian and author of Tears of Guduhav on 91.9 KVCR and streaming online at kvcrnews.org. I'm Ben Perper. The story of Tears of Guduhav is set somewhere in Tennessee in Civil War times, but it's framed as a story told to a young boy by an older Southerner in Glencoe, Alabama. Where did you get the setting of Glencoe?
Glencoe was where my grandfather lived, and the gas station was one that I really describe, where I really met this man. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that much about the man other than the description that I gave you in the book, and other than the fact that my grandfather would go there almost every time that I would go down and visit him, and he would talk to the owners, and at the same time, this other gentleman who was a great storyteller would regale me with wonderful stories of delight.
So the frame story is pretty much autobiographical then in that sense. It's really you. It's your memories.
In the sense that, yes, I was a 10-year-old kid and that took place, yeah.
Great. The book is full of period-specific knowledge of everything from how to build a water sluice to what types of wild berries grow in Tennessee. What kind of research did you do for this book?
Most of those things came from my knowledge of growing up in the South in the Appalachian Mountains. And whenever you would go to an old grist mill or a water mill, you would see these big water wheels that were used for the very thing that we're talking about in the book. But the same thing with gathering berries, everything from persimmons to blackberries to blueberries. I did that as a kid. In fact, I even did it this summer when I was back in the Deep South and picking berries and just enjoying the experience again. So those are things that really took place in my upbringing, and I wanted to add those so that people would know this is a real experience that these people went through because it was a real experience that I went through.
At one point in the story, Tears of Guduhav makes a kind of self-referential nod to Mark Twain, who was writing during the time the story takes place. Did you take inspiration from Twain's novels?
A little bit, especially in some of the characters. When you flesh out a character and you want people to know what they're like, many times people can see a Tom Sawyer or a Huckleberry Finn because of the descriptions, the word descriptions that he would give you. So I do that in several of the characters in this particular book as well. And because it took place during the height of his popularity, the coinciding of I'm not going to reveal too much of the story, but what was being told in the story was spun almost like a Mark Twain story. And as a result, people kind of compared the two.
Yeah. We've been speaking with John Pate, comedian and author of Tears of Guduhav. This is KVC Arts. I'm Ben Perper. Can you describe the book's cover and tell us a little bit about why you chose the images you did?
Because it takes place in the Appalachian Mountains and it takes place during the Civil War, there are many canyons and mountains and passes that people traveled, especially back then, that you would never be able to find again. And because of those areas, even in the Smoky Mountains, all the way from Georgia all the way up to Virginia, there are places in those mountains and passes that people still haven't explored. And the cover of the book kind of gives you that virgin area of where the mountains meet the clouds and the smoky, mystical relevance of that. But then also we have the two cross swords, both the Union and the Confederate cross sword from the Civil War, to let people know that this is a story about the Civil War and what takes place to the people that were affected by the Civil War. Plantation owners, Native Americans, slaves, Confederate soldiers, Union soldiers, all the way up to congressmen and even the leader of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis.
Definitely. So speaking of all the different types of people that were in the story, one passage in the book reads, "The challenges of the human condition, all of these mixed races in Guduhav, all in the same situation, now resided in that room together. Nothing more needed to be said. Despite the challenges and tragedies that the community faces in the novel, they form something like a multiracial utopia for a while. Where did you get the idea to create such a community set during and after the Civil War?
The idea of all of them coming together because they were trapped together is one of those things where when you have to depend on other people for your very survival, I think that's one of the things that I wanted to really stress in the story, that these were people that were thrown together because of necessity. And when you start worrying about where your next meat is coming from or where your next shelter is coming from, you don't really worry that much about culture or race. You worry about mankind and you worry just about the idea that, you know, we need to forget any biases, we need to forget any prejudice, and thinking that anybody is in charge of another person is foreign to them because they just simply want to live together and survive together.
We're here with John Pate, comedian and author of Tears of Guduhav. This is KVC Arts. Tears of Guduhav is your first full-length novel. Do you have plans for future novels?
This is, again, I believe that this is probably the only one that's in me because of the story, but the story itself was compelling enough for me to want to tell. Now, I do have a surprise for you. Mm-hmm. I won't tease the audience with this, but what you are able to witness there, don't tip it off because I want people to read the book, but there's a surprise ending, and this is the surprise ending that you're looking at right now.
Yes, I do understand that, actually. That's really cool. Okay, I won't tip off the audience.
Okay, then. Good. But at least maybe this will compel people to go on Amazon and order the book.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. That's the benefit of audio.
Exactly.
Yeah. So where can people find your book?
The book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the different bookstores that you find online. It's printed by Mr. Media Books in St. Petersburg, Florida, but you can order it anywhere.
Okay, great.
That was Ben Perper in conversation with John Pate. More about John at johnpatecomedy.com. You're listening to KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the program now, it's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Marcus Collins of the Texas Tenors on KVCR-TV quite soon.
So you've most recently, in 2009, become a Texas tenor. But you've been in show business industry for many years, right?
Long time. And when I was a kid, I started out doing musical theater. I was in Sound of Music when I was little. And my dad was very much a stage mom. And I did a lot of talent shows and county fairs. I've definitely been in show business a long time. And, of course, in front of the mirror at home, too. And that's show business, right?
Absolutely. It is. It was in my house, anyway. Was it years of maybe playing to one-night stands or in small venues when you were first trying to get into the business?
Most definitely. I first started just singing for family and friends, and again, county fairs and talent shows and things like that. So mostly outdoor functions. And just grew into doing cruise ships. I ended up working on cruise ships for about 6 years with Celebrity Cruise Line. And that's how I met JC. We met doing production shows. And I never really thought that I would be in a Texas classical crossover trio with JC. He has a beautiful classical voice and a great country voice, and I mostly pop and theater. And Texas was just a very natural fit for us. We all had cowboy boots and cowboy hats in our closet, and we dusted them off and auditioned for America's Got Talent.
When you were growing up and you were kind of training to go into this, were you, like you said, singing in front of the mirror? You knew you loved to perform at a very early age, and then you got to college and decided to go classical? Or how did that journey come?
Well, when I started singing, mostly in talent shows, my dad was very much a stage mom. You know, he loved to take me to county fairs and sing in certain talent shows and competitions. So I started that when I was really young, and then that just developed into doing choir and swing choir and musicals in school. And then some semi-professional theater companies as well. I was in the Sound of Music when I was a kid, and a couple other musicals as well. But my dad, he was very encouraging when it came to that. And so I started just by listening to the radio and emulating my favorite artists.
And who were they?
Garth Brooks, Michael W. Smith for gospel music, Freddie Mercury of Queen, Elton John. So that was definitely my voice developing at that time. So I've combined, I guess, not really copying, but kind of copying them, and then sort of finding my own sound within that. And then I got the opportunity to go to college and got a scholarship and was able to train classically with an amazing teacher, Michael Phillipson, at Indiana Hills Community College in Iowa. And he was a great teacher, and he taught me so many things about classical music and the foundation for the classical voice. And I had an enormous amount of respect for him. And then just continued on working with different teachers and training classically. And
so you knew classical was what you thought you wanted to do?
Well, I was encouraged by my high school music teacher, Mary Parker, and then also by Michael Phillipson in college, because classical music gives you the foundation to keep your voice for a long time. You know, a lot of times you hear about singers that have lost their voice or have surgeries or have nodes or maybe don't use their voice properly. Classical music, that training has given me the foundation to be able to sing, I hope, until I'm 105 years old, because classical training is, you can't beat that. And it gives you that longevity, and it gives you the ability to sing all these different styles, but sing them properly.
Well, very good. Makes sense. Now, you performed in musical plays. I read that you performed in Hairspray, Forever Plaid as Jinx, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Now, were those in high school? Were those in college? Or when did you do that? Or was that on a ship?
Those were professional companies between college and cruise ships. I worked at the Stage Door Players Company in Atlanta, Georgia, and started out as chorus and understudy for Joseph and the voice of the Pharaoh, because actually, I don't know if you're familiar with the show, but the Pharaoh didn't sing, but he looked the part, and I didn't look the part at the time. So I sang for him backstage, and he lip-synced. Yeah. So then the Joseph actually got sick, and then I ended up going on as Joseph and continued the rest of the production as Joseph. And
darn all the luck for Joseph getting sick, darn it. Hope he's doing better now.
he's doing great now. His name is Billy, and he's doing just fine.
Okay, good.
When I am down and oh, my soul so weary, and troubles come and my heart burden me, then I am still and wait here in silence until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I am on your shoulders. And raise me up to more than I can be.
So let's talk about, how did the three of you come together as a group? You were each artists in your own right.
John, probably the most classical singer of the three of us, he has done many, many operas around the country. He's been in many opera companies. He trained and worked at the Metropolitan Opera House, and actually he sold playbills and programs there, which is kind of funny. But JC grew up in the country. He never sang as a kid in high school. He's definitely the high school musical story. He was playing basketball, and they needed someone to sing the national anthem, so he stepped out before the game and sang the national anthem, and the crowd cheered, and he felt that rush from the first time that you sing in front of people, besides on the farm, you know, with his cows and his...
They probably loved him just as much, too.
And so, yeah, so JC came into music later than John and I did. John's family was very musical, his parents, music teachers, and his mom taught piano. For me, like I said before, my dad started pushing me out there into talent shows when I was 4 years old. So I was that little kid with the giant microphone that was bigger than
his
head,
you, huh?
Singing It's a Small World. So,
And so how did you guys come together? Was it for America's Got Talent? Was that the purpose of your coming together? And did you know of each other?
It was the reason why we came together. I've known JC for almost 16 years now. We're the best of friends, like brothers. Then John, I met through JC. JC and John met doing construction work, and he happened to hear John singing opera in the other room. They were doing drywall, and heard this incredible voice. And so they struck up a conversation about music and became friends. And JC, it was his idea to put the group together to audition for America's Got Talent in 2009. So he called me up and he said, hey, do you wanna be in this group with us? We're gonna do this country classical group. And, you know, he was in Houston at the time and I had just moved from Houston. And we thought, well, okay, let's give it a shot. So the three of us got together. We, again, dusted off the boots and hats and went to the thrift store and bought $7 dress shirts and some $5 bolo ties and $10 tux jackets from the Goodwill. And we went in front of the judges in Houston at the Wortham Center and sang our guts out for about 3 minutes. And they put us through to the first round. And the rest is, yeah, I guess.
What was on your audition tape when you submitted it to America's Got Talent?
So the audition tape, JC, his wife, she runs pageants, six pageants around the country. And we went to Kansas to sing at the Miss Kansas pageant in 2009. I think we filmed us singing La Donna Mobile, Nessun Dorma, and You Raise Me Up. So we combined those three songs together, mixed a videotape together. Boy, that dates
wow.
us, doesn't
yeah.
it? It was a videotape. Wasn't it? Was it a videotape?
Yeah, I'm
it, was,
sure it was,
yeah. It's
yeah.
crazy. I don't even know if I even have any of those left. Then we sent the videotape to America's Got Talent, and they called us to come in and audition. And we sang Mountain Music for the auditions.
So let's talk about the Texas Tenors and the tour and what it's meant for you, JC, and for John.
It's changed our lives. I mean, this is all we do now. This is our livelihood. This is how we make money for our families. This is how we'll save for our future. And this is how John and JC will pay for college for their kids. You know, this is our life now. And we've done almost 700 concerts since the TV show. And we've traveled. We've been to China. We filmed a music video on the Great Wall of China for You Should Dream, the song. And we did a 24-city tour of the United Kingdom in 2010. We've toured all over the country. We've performed with numerous symphonies, including the Phoenix Symphony, which is on the PBS special. And the Desert Symphony in Palm Desert, California, three times we've been with them, and Cleveland Pops. I mean, it just goes on and on. And we look at it now and we just think, wow, what would we have done if we didn't have this group and we didn't have each other and we weren't such great friends? Because we do get along really well.
That's great. It's always nice to
yeah.
you hear that, but then you always wonder if they
it's
really
true.
Do,
it really is true. I mean, good. We have our moments. But.
Of course. Especially on probably like some of the longer trips. So, who came up with the group's name? What were the other names that were tossed in the ring before?
That's actually a very good question. No one's ever asked me that question before. That's awesome. The Texas Tenors' origins are Houston-based. We all lived in Houston at one time or another. JC's wife is from Jersey Village. His family's from Katy. I lived in Houston for many years. John lived in Sugar Land and trained Nacogdoches. So the Texas Tenors was basically formed. We're all tenors. And Texas just exemplifies what we are. We all have country roots, but we have a classical sound. We're all from small towns or the farm, and we all have such a deep ingrained country culture in our backgrounds, but yet have trained classically. So it just made sense. Other names that we tossed around. Tre Voce was one of the names. It means three voices in Italian. And we thought about that, Tre Voce. In fact, we even sent the tape to America's Got Talent as the Texas Tenors, but we said to them, hey, you know, we're also thinking about this name, Tre Voce. They loved the Texas Tenors. That was it. And it was much better fit for us. Because you see a group called Tre Voce advertised, it would be more like Il Divo, I guess. You'd think, oh, it's going to be all Italian. Or
well, I think you made a good choice because if you'd gone with the other and people were Googling you,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't have known how to spell it. Texas Tenors,
yeah, how do you spell
right
Tre Voce?
You know,
I don't even know if I know now.
So
but,
there you go.
But yeah, and we may be doing an all-classical album in a couple of years, and we're actually going to name that album Tre Voce.
There
right,
you go.
As a
so
little nod to the...
Comes around.
Over in the, yeah.
Okay, so your first PBS special, You Should Dream. Will you share the story behind the song, which actually ended up being the title of the PBS special?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me the story of that.
So we got this song from Dana Lamb. And Dana is a mom and a school teacher. She's from Atlanta, Georgia. And she told us that she wrote this song back in 2007 while she was playing with her two kids. And she grabbed the closest thing to her, which was a purple marker, and she scribbled the song on an envelope because the music and the lyrics came to her all at once, and she talks about it as a very divine moment in her life that this music just flooded her and the words just flooded her. And she didn't do anything with it for a couple of years, and then she saw us on the show and she emailed it to us, sent us an MP3, sent us the lyric sheet, and she talked about her teaching and her kids and how much her kids meant to her, her students, as well as her own children. And just the letter really spoke to us because all three of our parents are teachers, or were teachers. My father passed away. It just really touched us, and just the letter that she sent. And then we listened to the song and read the lyrics as we listened, and it was just the most beautiful, simple song that just spoke to us. Everything about it, the lyrics just took us on a journey, and it was our journey, and it was so many people's journey, because so many people, they just don't realize that they just got to keep going. You know, they just got to keep fighting for their dreams. And you know, if we had given up, then we would never be the Texas Tenors. I would still be off doing customer service work. JC would be doing real estate or construction or something. And who knows? And we've had the opportunity to sing in front of so many people, and I think inspire a lot of people too. So You Should Dream, we listened to it and we called her and had an amazing conversation. And this was the very first song that she ever wrote.
Wow.
And it completely changed our whole focus. We decided to call our album You Should Dream. We cut Borderline from the record. And when we went to go to filming a special for public television, there was no better name than You Should Dream.
Now, you mentioned briefly that you have performed in China. How was that experience? Because it's not easy to perform in China. Don't you have to go through a lot just to be able to perform?
There was a lot of red tape. We had to be approved by the government to perform for its citizens. It was a very long process. I think we worked with the presenter for over 2 years before we finally were able to go over. And it changed from 6 concerts to 1 because we had a very limited availability for the amount of performances by foreign entities.
How was the audience?
It was very good. In fact, they started dancing in the aisles during the country songs. They were singing along. They got the jokes.
Wow.
Yeah, we didn't have to change anything. We purposely didn't change anything. They asked us to change some things. Well, because, you know, I think that's why they brought us, you know, and they really did enjoy it very much. The experience overall was, it was challenging, I have to say. It was really good to come home.
Appreciate
yeah,
America.
It really does make you appreciate. And, you know, when people say something about regulations about pollution and how, you know, the government regulates too many things, and I really wish that they would just go over to China for a week and then experience no
really
regulations.
Right.
Because I tell you what, I thank God every day to live here and to have those regulations on pollution, because it's extremely bad. Extremely bad over there.
All right, let me ask you, it's really important to me, when selecting your finale song of any concert, you really want to leave your audience in a good mood, with a great song, mm-hmm. with a great experience, mm-hmm. and you guys chose My Way. Why My Way?
Well, My Way has been a personal favorite of mine for many, many years. It was my dad's favorite song, and when we decided on the order of the tunes and what we would put in the order, I really wanted us to do My Way. John loves the song. JC likes it a lot, but it didn't really click until we just did it once. We put it in the show. We ended with it. My arrangement is a little bit different than the normal arrangement. It ends kind of with a tenor sort of ending. And John actually arranges all of our vocals. And so he took it and made it so interesting and so creative and beautiful. It's sentimental. And some people would think that it leaves you down, but actually it does leave you up. It does leave you uplifted. And if you know the song or you love the song and you really feel the lyrics and you understand it, then you do feel that you leave the concert uplifted and inspired. And, you know, we have a lot of people who say, well, have you ever thought about singing God's Way? Because there's a version called God's Way. And, you know, we've tossed around that idea. But you know what? It's an iconic song. It's beautiful. We sang it for America's Got Talent, and we love it. And I don't see us closing with something different anytime soon, but that's not to say that that might not change someday soon, but you just never know.
You're involved with a few charities. You each have a charity that you kind of spearhead. Mm-hmm. What are those charities?
We work with Homes for Our Troops, which is an organization that provides retrofitting for soldiers' homes when they come home if they've been wounded. For example, if they live in a house that has a lot of stairs and they can't get into the home, they'll build ramps. I did not serve, so I would not ever pretend to get in their heads, but I imagine that it would be so much easier and so much better transition to be able to come home and to be able to get into your house right away. to not have to worry about someone lifting up your chair into your home. And they just do these kind of things for the soldiers when they come home. And I think it means a lot to them. And we've seen it firsthand. We've experienced the homecomings. And the organization is very good. And so much of that dollar goes to...
So veterans has been kind of your focus.
Right. And we also work with the Child Fund International. And Child Fund, as you know, provides so many things for kids outside of the U.S., like clean drinking water and, right. and food. They also have kids here at home as well. So that's another reason why we partner with the Child Fund and talk about them at every show, because they have children here in the U.S. as well.
So veterans and children mm-hmm. are your focus.
And then also I work with ASPCA. So, you know, we try to do as much as we can,
right.
you know, because we see so many people. We're in front of so many people, and I think that it would be wrong or... It would be fair to people who don't have a platform, who really want to talk to people about certain things. It would be wrong not to at least mention it. Like, we don't shove it down people's throats.
But you try and do your part.
Yeah, we try to, yeah, exactly.
Because you do have the platform to be in front of an audience.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, let me ask you just two more things. What do you get asked when fans see you? What's the most common thing they're asking you?
How do you leave your dogs for so long? I have two bulldogs, Bella and Fella.
That you rescued, right?
I rescued them from Alaska. Right, just before the America's Got Talent live rounds. So I've had them ever, you know, they've definitely been part of the experience with me. I just love them so much.
So maybe there's not a common question. I was just thinking maybe you get asked something all the time. I don't know if you do meet and greets or...
Oh, yeah, we have a meet and greet after every show. We sign CDs and T-shirts and things after every show, and we wait till everybody's through the line.
Maybe they don't ask you a question, but they always say, oh, thank you for...
You know, people do ask similar questions, like, why aren't you married yet? That's definitely a common question. And John always says, well, we're taking applications. There's a $50 application fee. It goes to Homes for Our Troops.
you can keep up that gig for a while. You'll raise some money for nonprofits.
Well, actually, this is so silly. A JC decided to put my hotel key on eBay, and I signed it just for fun. He said, sign this hotel key for me. And I was like, okay. So it ended up on eBay, and he put my hotel key, which is didn't work at all because we moved on from that hotel, obviously.
Of course.
So it was just random hotel key. I signed it, and it was dinner with the Texas Tenors, you know, any place along the tour of their choosing. And it raised $1,700.
Just for your key and your signature.
Yeah, it was for a food drive. And then we gave $500 to Child Fund and then the rest to the food drive. Yeah.
Marcus, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Marcus Collins. You can see the Texas Tenors on KVCR-TV with air dates of August 27th, September 2nd, and September 9th. More on the Texas Tenors at thetexastenors.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Marcus Collins, John Pate, Emmanuel Rogers, and Dan White. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Ben Perper, Mike Pesavento, and Izzy Gordon. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.